And if anyone is here for Senate Bill 591 or Senate Bill 114, neither of those are going to be dealt with today. First up, Senate Bill 81 in Dale Penn. Works or public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. I'm a member of a work group that worked under the direction of the Interim Judiciary Committee concerning domestic violence and deferred sentencing programs. And out of that work group came Senate Bill 81, which is before you today. I would note, if I could, that a couple of the witnesses that are signed up, Katie Vetter, who is representing the Coalition Against the Oregon Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence, needs to leave in a couple of minutes, and Hardy Myers needs to leave around 2:30. I might propose that I could give a very brief overview and perhaps call those witnesses up, and then I could finish going through the bill, if that would be okay, Mr. Chair.
That's fine.
So I simply say this Senate Bill 81 comes to you as a work group proposal. We had several legislators from the Interim Judiciary Committee, batterer intervention program providers, defense lawyers, prosecutors, representatives of domestic violence victim organizations, as well as representatives from domestic violence shelters. And the need came forward because there was a statute passed last session that authorized deferred sentencing programs. However, because of the unique nature of domestic violence programs were exempted from that deferred sentencing process for other misdemeanor crimes. And so the interim project was designed to look at what would be the appropriate legal process and legal standards for a deferred sentencing program that involved domestic violence. Should there be standards for batterer intervention programs in domestic violence cases? And what can be done about supervision of those offenders in these deferred sentencing domestic violence programs? And so those were the issues that we tried to deal with and which Senate Bill 81 addresses in more detail. With that, it probably would be a good idea to ask Ms. Vetter and Mr. Myers to testify, and then I can go through a little more in the detail of what the statute proposes. But if that would be fine.
You bet. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Minnis, members of the committee. My name is Katie Yetter, and I'm a staff attorney for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. The coalition supports Senate Bill 81 for a couple of reasons, and you can read my written testimony at your leisure. Let me just summarize what's in there. The first reason we support this bill is because a lot of counties in Oregon already offer batterer intervention as a sanction for offenders. In fact, some counties automatically send perpetrators to batterer intervention because they lack the jail space. What this bill will do is create standards for batterer intervention programs, which is important because some of the programs that are out there and what they call batterer intervention is often something else and is in fact inappropriate for batterers. The second reason we support this bill is because there are a number of safety measures for victims of domestic violence. They have the opportunity to be notified of the progress of the program, there's an opportunity to supervise the offender while in the program. And we don't look at this necessarily as a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's a tool which allows domestic violence offenders to know the state means business and will not tolerate domestic violence. Not only can a defendant participate only once in this program, but there are sanctions for failure to comply with the provisions of the agreement and an upgrade to felony status for repeat offenses. So I urge your favorable consideration of Senate Bill 81 and would welcome any questions that you may have.
I don't think we have any at this point.
Thank you.
Is your organization like the primary domestic violence advocacy group, or are there others that...
We are a nonprofit network of domestic violence and sexual assault service providers, and we have member programs across the state of Oregon.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman, and members. For your record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. I wanted to address just the Section 6 of the bill, although I'm certainly want to express support for the bill as a whole. Section 6 is the portion of the bill that directs the development of standards for batterer intervention programs that receive offenders under this particular bill. Two quick comments. First, it's my impression, though professionals can speak to this a lot more informed basis, that there is a good deal marching under the banner of batterer intervention these days that's very ineffectual, and that there is genuinely a need for the development of standards around such service efforts. Secondly, when the bill was being developed, I was asked if at least, if I happened to be serving again as Attorney General, I would support having the responsibility to develop those standards vested in my office. And I said I would welcome that responsibility. It was my understanding there would be an advisory committee requirement, which is in the bill. And so I simply wanted to affirm to the committee personally that if this bill advances and it's the committee's decision to retain Section 6 in its current form, I would indeed certainly welcome the opportunity to be part of that standards development promulgation. In any event, I think wherever placed, the development of those standards is an extremely important further step in the evolving battle against domestic violence and sexual assault in Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Could you just briefly maybe explain how you would go about developing the standards?
Well, I'm not sure I could give you a detailed prophecy right now of how it would evolve. The first step, I think, would be to create the advisory committee within the requirements of the bill itself. I think that from talking with Connie Gallagher, who is administrator of our Crime Victims Assistance Section, there are already in existence fairly sophisticated, fairly what are viewed as fairly high-quality standards from which at least the working group and I could begin that work. In other words, this is not an area in which there hasn't been some measure of what's viewed as quality prior activity.
Right, and that's really the reason I asked the question, because by virtue of the fact it's here, it assumes that there aren't any standards. But I guess what you're telling me is you'd pull the varying existing standards from the work done, I assume, by district attorneys. No?
Chair Menace, I have not had more specific information about the standards that Ms. Gallagher was referring to that I've just relayed to you, but it's not my impression that they are Oregon-based standards. They've been developed outside Oregon.
Okay.
I just wonder if the Attorney General would mind expanding a little bit on your comment. There are a lot of bad programs out there, commercial kinds of things, or what did you mean by that?
Chairman and Senator Duncan, what I'm referring to is my understanding from, it's primarily from my work on the Governor's Council on Domestic Violence, that there are some approaches to batter intervention. Anger management, I think, is one I've heard mentioned frequently, that are not effective. There may be, perhaps Mr. Bill Penn could speak to this too, there may be others who will be testifying on this bill who are professionally connected to this whole issue that could speak to that more knowledgeably. But I know that is a serious concern and is part of the part of what animated the creation of this section in the bill.
Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, I might simply add that some states have tried to adopt standards in statute. And so the state of Washington actually for domestic violence has a whole set of standards for batterer intervention programs. We really don't think that's a wise decision. And so that was discussed, however, in the work group, and the idea was that that really should be a rule process and would be much more efficient. So some states have adopted standards either by rule or by statute. Our state, about 8 years ago, the Chief Justice appointed a work group comprised of a lot of judges and then others, domestic violence victim advocates and others, and actually produced a booklet of proposed standards for Oregon. And I would think that would be a starting point, and then gathering what else has come forward in research and in other states. I think that'd probably be the process they would follow.
Mr. Chair, I certainly agree with you that when you start putting things like that in statute, and I'm constantly talking about this in many other areas too, then you can't move around very easily. By doing it with the administrative rule, you've got some flexibility. If you find a program doesn't work, you can shift and so forth. So certainly concur on that.
All right. Thank you, Hardy.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'll pick up again then, starting to discuss the bill itself. As I said, I think there are three major components of this bill. And first of all is the legal process of a deferred sentencing program. What does that look like? What does it do? First of all, it would require an offender to come into court and admit their guilt. And this is very important as far as validating the victim and making a public statement that violence is wrong. Now, what happens at that point is that the court would defer any action on that case at that time. The defendant would waive a number of speedy trial issues and timing issues, and in effect have entered their plea, but then they would be placed on probation for a period of time, and they would be placed in a batterer's intervention program, that program which complied with the standards that were developed by the Attorney General. And there would be various other assignments to the offender at that time, such as having no contact with the victim unless authorized, and complying with not engaging in future violence, and it may involve alcohol or drug treatment as part of this. The main intent is to intervene, stop the violence, have some kind of process where the offender may be held accountable, will acknowledge this is wrong, and will make a choice not to engage in that conduct in the future, all the time trying to provide some safety mechanisms for the victim. One of the problems we ran into was, will this process have immigration law ramifications? And immigration can look at a conviction for a domestic violence crime as a basis to deport or to refuse to allow someone to stay in the United States legally. Just as a note, since this is the beginning of baseball season, a year ago, there was a pitcher, I think he's with Colorado Rockies, his name is Pedro Estacio. And a year and a half ago, he's from the Dominican Republic, a year and a half ago, he entered a program, a deferred sentencing program, in the state of Colorado, and he was trying to come back to the United States for spring training. And he was refused entrance because the Immigration Department treated participation in a deferred sentencing program the same as a conviction, even though he was participating in the program and was was not reoffending. So that was a major concern for victim advocates and for victims, that we would have some victims not report violence against them because of their fear of immigration law ramifications for their family unit if they did report. And so that was something that we didn't want to have happen. This process does not involve the court in initiating the deferred sentencing agreement. That is between the district attorney and the defense attorney and the offender. And the reason for that is, if there is court involvement, it will have immigration law ramifications. But this was patterned after a program in Washington, D.C., and the idea is that the district attorney will decide under criteria under the bill if this person fits the right standards for entrance into the program, and then will offer that and will simply bring that forward to the judge. The judge will simply receive the plea and defer further actions. And we've been assured by immigration lawyers that that process will not have immigration law ramifications. And so that is what has been built into this as well.
Dale, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Kind of on the same point. On the first part of the bill, says that line 15 says the defendant is eligible to enter into a domestic violence deferred sentencing agreement only once.
Yes.
But I'm assuming that if a person successfully completes this deferred sentencing agreement, that there's no conviction anywhere. Is that right? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, the way I would see this happening is that they are going to be arrested initially, and so we should have a LEDS entry about that arrest. And then we should have an OGIN entry saying that a charge was filed. And then it would read essentially that there was a agreement, and it may be like a diversion type code there. But ultimately, if they did not reoffend and they completed the batterer intervention program, it would show as a dismissal. Now, as we are reviewing someone's case history in deciding whether or not do they fit the criteria under the bill, that is something we would look at. And obviously, if we saw a dismissal, we'd want to check and make sure, is that a deferred sentencing program? That's the way I'd see us, the district attorney's office, looking for that type of thing.
And I guess the point that I'm getting to is that it isn't really clear. It says only once, but only once in relationship to what? I guess, is the intent that it's only once in a person's lifetime?
Mr. Chair, I believe so.
I think saying that in the bill would be much more clear. The reason I raise the point is that it's the only complaint or concern that I've had from anyone about this bill is that it seems to be vague that you could successfully complete this program, you don't have a conviction, and then reoffend, and then it gets missed, or the law is not clear, and suddenly you're back into another diversion agreement. And they found that to be somewhat offensive. So.
And, Mr. Chair, I agree with that. The difficulty in keeping records, that's always a problem, because our record systems are never totally accurate. We constantly under-sentence people because we don't know about prior convictions. I don't have a good solution to that, other than we did try to build into the bill later on page 5, the concept of someone who enters one of these programs, and in effect they are given a dismissal because they at least complete the terms during that time, but then they reoffend at a later time. That will count as an aggravator to make this second offense now a felony offense. If someone is currently in the program and then they reoffend, then the fact that they entered this program is going to count as a prior conviction also for the felony upgrade. So we tried to at least bring that into this program, and again as more motivation not to reoffend in the future. But the real key question you're asking about is, will we be 100% confident that our record systems will always identify someone who is in one of these programs? And I would have to say no.
Well, and it's that plus, I can see an attorney arguing that that the bill doesn't say or the law doesn't say that it's restricted to their lifetime, and so
yeah.
You know, having successfully completed it, although it might be, you know, an aggravator, mm-hmm. that's kind of a decision of the court. So I get to see somebody arguing that their particular defender or client should be eligible or should be allowed.
Yeah.
And if it's not clear, some district attorney somewhere may say, well, yeah, it's okay with me.
Certainly. And, Mr. Chair, we'd have no problem with putting that in there. And I think that would be the intent of the work group in the discussion of this language. And so we can certainly add that. That would be fine. So that kind of gives you at least the legal process that is set up here. And what we've tried to do on pages 1 and 2 is to give some guidance to district attorneys about What is the base level here for programs throughout the state? And so we've talked about this can only apply to misdemeanor crimes. You need to take into account what the person's prior history is. And so we've just detailed in the bill some reminders of these are the criteria that you need to look at, and some of the issues you need to take into account in offering this type of program to someone. On page 3 is section 3 where we talk about the prohibitions that one cannot enter a deferred sentencing agreement to someone who's been convicted in Oregon of a felony crime, a person felony, or is awaiting sentencing now on a person felony, and certainly not for someone who's been charged with a felony assault 4. That's that sub 3 there under section 3. And so those are prohibitions.
Let me ask you another question. What was the rationale with restricting to the conviction of a felony in Oregon only?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, restricting it to Oregon or any state, it does go forward. Any state or jurisdiction you'd have to look at are the circumstances of this felony in some other state the same as a person felony in Oregon. So it isn't restricted just to Oregon. It is open to other states and jurisdictions.
Should read the bill, huh?
Mm-hmm. Now, what would happen to the offender then is they would be ordered to enter this batterer intervention program, and much of the bill talks about access of information to the batterer intervention program about this offender, and so that they have an accurate view of what is going on and the ability to know how someone is getting along in their program, and that they and have some confidence that they are not reoffending. Section 6 is the part of the bill that the Attorney General just addressed, which we've listed 5 different areas that we believe it is important for the Attorney General and the work group to develop rules and standards for our state on these issues. A problematic part of this bill is probation supervision, and that's sections 10 and beyond. The intent was that we believe these offenders are offenders that need to have probation supervision because of a victim safety issue. Some counties have used general fund dollars to pay for this kind of supervision. Unfortunately, under the rules for reimbursement by the state, counties do not receive state funds for probation supervision of misdemeanants. And so that creates a real problem for this type of program. If you're going to supervise these offenders, there needs to be some resources to do that. The bill, as proposed, requested those resources, and it would have a fiscal impact. I've been told it would be somewhere in the $3 to $4 million range. That is a major problem during this session. So we do have some Dash 1 amendments, and I'll briefly tell you how they enter into this whole process. The first couple of amendments are...
Before you get to that, can I ask you a couple of questions?
Yes, certainly.
I was just wondering on page 1 where the person is asked to waive former Jeffrey rights under the federal and state constitution. And those are rights you can waive.
Mr. Chair, yes. The Supreme Court has pretty much advised us that a defendant can waive any right. Now, since I just had a death penalty case reversed on whether a defendant can waive ex post facto rights, I think that's very clear. This is designed to get at a situation where perhaps there is a low-level driving charge and a domestic violence charge arrested at the same time. And the choice may be that, all right, the main issue here is domestic violence. We are going to put you into this program if you admit your responsibility, but we're going to hold this other charge. And if you don't get through this program appropriately, or you reoffend, or you end up getting sentenced on this, we at least have the option, if we feel it's appropriate, to prosecute you for this other charge that we set aside. That's the only reason for that part.
All right. Thank you. Have there been some changes in the court decisions on waiving constitutional rights? And it seems to me that in past judiciary committees, we've had discussions where there was questions as to whether you could or could not waive certain.
Mr. Chair, I think it's always an open question until you get a specific opinion about a particular right, and so that issue of ex post facto was one that was open for a while that clearly has been decided now. And I know that whenever I've argued this type of thing, as long as a defendant is knowingly and intelligently dealing with the issue, and particularly when you have advice of legal counsel, I personally believe that they have the ability to waive almost any right. This particular provision is actually in place in Multnomah County right now in a couple of programs, and I really don't think that's a problem in this bill.
Thank you.
So let me move to the Dash 1 amendments, if that would be okay, or if there are other questions you might have. And quickly just going through here, some of the issues that we tried to do, and this was a work group just in the last month, and trying to deal with the funding issue, is that in Section 1 of the bill, we're proposing to amend line 6. And the effect of this amendment would be that there are crimes, this bill only applies to domestic violence, which would primarily be assault and menacing. However, we really believed that there are situations where there may not have been a physical assault, but there still is a domestic violence crime that has been involved. You may have seen a situation where actor Jim Brown was involved in the last year in a prosecution in Los Angeles. He did not strike his wife. He broke out every window in the car while she was sitting in the driver's seat of that car. Was she frightened? Yes, very much so. But that was a criminal mischief case, and our desire was to allow this to be a little broader so that you might have the criminal mischief kind of scenario or other type of crime, although the main thrust of this will be assaults and menacing cases. So that is the amendment there. On page 2, there is an amendment where the offender would not be allowed to have contact with the victim unless authorized, and the way the bill reads right now is authorized by the district attorney. After discussion on this, we believe that since this person would be under supervision of probation officer, that that really should read, unless authorized by the local supervisory authority. And so that's that amendment. Then, in line 23 of page 2, we deal with a situation where the offender violates the terms of the deferred sentencing agreement. And what happens at that point is they're simply brought back into court, and now they are sentenced because they've already entered their guilty plea and sentencing is going to take place. You'll see on the dash 1 amendments, lines 10 through 12, or lines 10 through 13, what we're proposing is if the sentencing takes place, and so the offender has violated the terms of the agreement, the district attorney shall recommend a sentence of imprisonment in the county jail if the violation of the condition of supervision was for menacing or harassing or assaulting the victim. So this is a situation where the person has come in and admitted their responsibility, entered a batterer intervention program, but then they go back and assault or menace or harass that same victim. And we believed in that scenario that there should be a recommendation of jail. Now, that is discretionary with the court, but we believe that was important. The rest of these amendments on page 3 and 4 of the dash 1 amendments, and then carrying forward to the top of page 2, there is a section of the bill that I haven't talked about, and that is section 5. And this section was added actually as a process for sentencing in misdemeanor and Class C felony assault cases that might involve domestic violence. It is not a deferred sentencing program, and it suggested an assessment and then a sentencing process that, a judge could use. We discovered that that particular section was drawing a lot of criticism from people in that we do not have assessment standards, and it was becoming very controversial. After discussion with some representatives from the Judicial Department, our recommendation is to delete that at this time. Certainly the court can still do this if they wish to in a particular case. They don't need statutory authority for it. But we believe that if we can move forward with Senate Bill 81, the Attorney General's work group develops standards for batterer intervention and these other issues, then perhaps next session we would have some history here, and at that point we might be able to deal with the issue of assessment standards and maybe this issue of sentencing for other cases. But our recommendation in the Dash 1 amendments remove that totally from the bill, and we think that's a wise decision. Which brings me to the last amendments here, of the Dash 1 amendments, and that's sections 11, 13, and section 14 amendments, pages 2, 3, and 4. This issue of funding of probation supervision, as I explained, is a very difficult problem. And I might note, just for the record, on the Dash 1 amendments, when it cites at line 16 on page 2, ORS 423.478 sub 2, that actually should read sub B rather than A. And that's repeated on line 27. And it's repeated on line 18 on page 3. And so each of those ORS citations should read sub 2 sub B, not sub 2 sub A. But what we tried to do with these amendments was to allow a local choice that and to remove the fiscal impact. That was our intent. Right now, as I explained, probation departments are only reimbursed or receive state funding for supervising felons, and these offenders are misdemeanors. In my own analysis, I believe that domestic violence misdemeanors who are engaged in personal violence are in more need of supervision than other categories of felons, just because of that personal violence and safety issue that comes forward. These amendments would allow a county unit to decide to, in effect, exchange some lower-level felons who are currently being supervised for some of these deferred sentencing misdemeanant domestic violence offenders. And they would not lose funding formula for that exchange. So that's the proposal. The difficulty is that you will hear from the counties that they would rather receive the money, and it's a difficult problem. I was looking for some way to remove the fiscal impact, because I'm fearful that if this does go to Ways and Means, it will die. It is a very good policy choice. It's been a lot of work's been put into this, and so I was looking for a way to make it cost neutral. I do believe this would do it. Right now, we still have the difficulty that probation departments believe they need the resource to do this, and that it really isn't going to be a good trade for them.
Okay, deal.
Yes.
We're going to run out of time.
Okay.
I want to kind of manage this. Paul Snyder, you're here from the counties. Do you have something brief you want to say, or is your concern the same concern that Dale's raising at this point?
It is the same.
Yeah.
All right. So we need a resolution to that somehow. Okay.
The dash one
basically guts it, but okay. And I'm thinking I want to have a little bit more discussion about this. Kevin, do you have just one point? I've got a couple of work sessions I want to do real quick here so that before we adjourn.
Kevin, members of the committee, Kevin Mannix from Salem. Obviously, I support this bill. I participated in a work group that developed it, so I won't give you that speech. The point that I'd make is that even if some adjustments have to be made so that this bill can be moved without funding, I think it ought to be put into the substantive law. It can be done if you put it into the substantive law, but a provision saying that each county can make a determination as to when a diversion program will go into effect, when they have lined up the funds to carry out the program, and once they've done that, whether it's state funds, federal funds, local funds, that they can then kick in the diversion program, and you've already got it on the statute books, so all that good work has not been lost. And this committee could do that substantively without sending this bill to Ways and Means, especially if you get the signal that Ways and Means will be a deep, dark hole for this bill because it will cost money. I think it's money well spent, but I realize that debate's for another place and time. Thank you.
Okay. Now, are there any other fees charged to people going into these agreements up front?
Mr. Chair, they would be paying for this batterer intervention program, and so that's going to be a cost. The intent is always to try to keep the cost as low as possible. We were talking about a family unit, in effect, but there would be that cost.
What is that? How much is that?
Mr. Chair, it may vary with each program, and I know that most programs try to use sliding scales, and I couldn't give you a figure off the top of my head, but I can get that for you.
Ballpark?
What's a cost of a program?
$500 in the fourth year.
Roughly $500, and we won't hold you to that, but at least it gives us a ballpark.
Yes. Okay.
Ms. Burroughs, former representative, are you here on this bill?
No, I just wanted to see you in action.
That's why we come. Senator Courtney just brought my attention to your presence, so.
Okay.
Which really hurts. She said she didn't want to see me, she wanted to see you, even though I brought her to attention, so that pretty much makes me feel.
Mr. Chair, I've known her longer than any of you.
No, you haven't.
Yes, I have.
You served with her in the House. You did not serve
with her
in the House.
I knew her before that.
Well, but you didn't serve with her.
Yeah, you knew Moses.
All right.
We're all fighting over you, Mary.
I was there 14 years, but
Could we, okay, I'm going to get her back here. Maybe we could move into work session, adopt the dash one amendments, and then see what it looks like after that. We'll bring it back. And
well, we have some problems with the dash ones, so unless you...
Oh, we do? Do we have initial... We have
you pointed out, wasn't the dash ones that have the A's and the B's?
That's correct. It should be a B instead of an A.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is the dash one amendment has a problem?
That's right. If you look at page 2 of the dash one amendments, and you look at section 11, it should be, instead of saying sub A there on line 16, I'm sorry, line 16, instead of sub A, it should read sub B. And then if you go through each of those sections where it refers to the same statute, it should always be sub B.
Right. Well, we'll bring this back when Legislative Council fixes it. Close public hearing. We're going to go into a work session on the agenda, which is here somewhere. Senate Bill 657.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move no amendments, Roger.
Well, I've got to get council staff up here. 657. Do I have a counselor?
It has a dash one. Did we do anything?
Not some lawyer. Thank you.
Have we done the dash one before?
Hi.
Got nice stuff of yours. I guess I spread out.
Yeah.
I take over.
Senate Bill 657 is a bill that allows the county sheriff to seek payment of amounts owed by prisoners that they've reduced to judgment through the Department of Revenue. There, you should have the dash three amendments, and those combine the amendments that were requested by the Oregon Collectors Association, the dash one amendments, and the dash two amendments that were worked out between DOJ and Steve Little of the Department of Revenue to clarify that the amounts do need to be reduced to a judgment. It adds some identifying information that the county will provide. And it also clarifies the authority of the Department of Revenue to apply their prioritization in terms of the payment of these various amounts that they might be assigned from an amount such as a tax refund check. It the amendment the collectors requested and that the Department of Revenue agreed with deleted Section 3 of the bill, which really is just a provision that deals only with state agencies and wasn't necessary and could impede the referral back to the local sheriff for further collection activity if the sheriff would so elect.
All right, so help me. We've got dash, you've got dash two, I've got dash three.
You've got dash three. Dash two.
Dash two are moved. We don't want
dash one and dash two are now merged and have become
all right.
Dash
so
three.
So procedurally, we need the adoption of dash
Mr.
one.
Chair, I move adoption of the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 657.
All right, Senator Duncan moves the adoption of the dash.
You're bringing a little power in there.
To Senate Bill 657. Mm-hmm. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Do we need the dash one?
No. It's in the dash
three. All right. Senator Courtney?
I would have sent Bill 657 as amended to Senate floor of the dispatch regulation.
Senator Courtney now moves Senate Bill 657 to the floor of the Senate as amended to the due pass recommendations. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And who would like to be the carrier of this?
You just came in. You don't carry it. You haven't been here. Anybody but Jenny Burdick carries this year.
Senator Duncan, would you like to carry a bill of substance?
I don't know if you can handle that.
I'm not sure I could. I could. I could do it.
Okay. Would you want to?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. Senator Duncan.
I don't miss a bit.
No, you'll be fine.
Okay, I'll be there for you, Vern.
Good.
Oh, this one's cutie. I want to carry this one.
All right. Senate Bill 704, work session, but we've got some testimony. And we're waiting for some amendments from legislative council.
This is strange.
Where's the amendments?
So who are my witnesses?
Oh, shoot, I don't have a card.
Yamhill County guy, come on up there.
Yeah, thank you.
Try to remember your name and, actually, I think I still have your card in my pocket.
Charles Stern.
There it is, right there, Charles Stern.
My old home county.
I always see this guy in rules. Charles.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk and I chair the Oregon Association of County Clerks Legislative Committee. We've presented a couple of conceptual amendments to this bill, which I think is at LC and not here. They do two things. One, it would delete lines 13 through 15 of the bill, which is the emergency clause. One of the things this bill would require is that the vital records and the clerks would have to sit down and design some new forms. And to have this bill go into effect upon passage would, it's kind of difficult to do that. So we would appreciate that being removed.
That's the only thing that you need. Is
the other one,
okay.
The other one deals with a section of statute that isn't in the bill. And in that section of statute, it requires that the person who is performing the ceremony note the time and place of the marriage in the return back to the clerks. Time means that you're going to show both the date and the time. And we are requesting that to be the date and place of marriage. What is happening in the real world is that ministers put down the date but not the time. So we're calling them up saying the law requires that you also list the time. In fact, on the form devised by the Vital Records Division, it has date, time, but time gets missed. And so we've asked several, what is the need for the time, and no one can seem to give us an answer. So we're asking that that word time be changed for date. So it's the date and place of marriage rather than the time and place of marriage. Those are the two conceptual amendments that that we're suggesting for this bill.
Sound good.
Okay. And do we have perhaps we can make a call down to legislative council to see if they're if it's possible. Oh, they did say 3 o'clock?
Yeah, they just called.
Okay. So we'll
are they doing just hearing these?
They're making them.
How about Tony and Tina's? They get married. They've been married, what, 800 times or something? I mean,
we're still on the record, by the way.
Can you imagine how the county clerk and, yeah, and Multnomah County, that's that business.
I wonder if they're officially married now.
Great play.
You don't know Tony and Tina?
No.
Haven't you been to see them?
They get married about 5 times a year.
Anybody else want to speak on this bill?
I just want to know, who is Tony and Tina?
Well, I can't believe you don't know.
All right, look,
everybody in this room,
like, you know Tony and Tina?
Yes.
Not personally, sir.
But I bet you've heard of them.
Everyone has.
Well, I haven't. So what am I going to hear of them?
Well, you just have to find out.
John?
He's going to get an invitation, huh? Tony and Tina?
Yeah, we'll give you an invitation.
Let's see, do you know
about
Tony and
Tina? Yeah. Take you. Why doesn't everyone know about... Reverend, do you know about Tony and Tina? Got married 5 times a day.
Wedding?
Tony and Tina.
I've heard about Tony and Tina.
See?
Here's the only one in America that in Oregon has
very sheltered life.
Nice to know something that Peter doesn't know. He knows everything.
Yeah.
John.
Peter Wong, don't laugh.
Peter, please don't take his picture and have a story about this. So.
We found a schism in your knowledge.
I took Senator Nelson and Allison and Donna and I went together.
amendments? Mr. Well, we're kind of chatting here. Anybody here have opposition to meeting at 5 o'clock
Mr. Chair,
once a week?
Are we in recess?
So far as you know.
Are we in recess?
Every week or just...
Are we in recess, Mr. Chair?
As needed.
That's fine. That's not quite...